Our goal is to make sure that great technology support, whether it's product management, design, qualitative research, security, reliability, scalability, all things engineering, can get to organizations that really need it as soon as possible and as accessibly as possible.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. My guest today, Zena Nee, is co-founder of Trestle Collaborative. That is an organization that provides technology advisors and consultants from the private sector to progressive technology and movement groups. For example, they have an Uptime project that helps progressive political tech scale their applications. I enjoyed hearing about Zena's route from product design to Trestle and what they are up to at Trestle now. If you're interested in political technology, you should definitely hear about Zena and her group. So, after a quick word from my sponsor, my interview with Zena Nee of Trestle Collaborative.
What do Blue State, Sierra Club, and Indivisible have in common? They all use Civic Shout to grow email lists that raise money like clockwork, and now, so can you. Instead of vaporizing money with Facebook ads or burning bridges with spam, a new wave of digital directors are helping Democrats and nonprofits acquire opt-ins and nail their monthly goals with Civic Shout. Environmental action called Civic Shout, a wildly better way to grow your email list. And Clarify Agency saw a 200% return on ad spend in just 2 months. Head to civicshout.com/partners to learn more and schedule a demo. That's civicshout.com/partners.
Zena, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. All right. Hello. My name is Zena Nee. I am currently a founding partner at Trestle Collaborative. I grew up mostly in the nuclear desert of rural Washington State in a town called Richland, which is part of the Tri-Cities, which grew in the 1940s as part of the Manhattan Project. I say nuclear desert because it's where we refined a bunch of materials for the bomb that got dropped on Nagasaki, ending World War II. And growing up, I was aware of the historical importance, but only as an adult have really come to understand all the different dynamics of this desert town and how it kind of connects to larger patterns in society in America.
What kind of family?
We were all immigrants. My family is fairly close, scrappy, exploring, understanding America together in our own individual ways. I feel very appreciative that it was intergenerational. My parents were able to bring my grandparents over, and they helped raise me for a lot of my childhood. And that's an important part of shaping who I am now.
Was it political at all in the sense of American politics?
Yes and no. I will say yes, because, well, strap in, this might be a longer answer. I will say yes, because aside from working in political tech, I am also an artist. And in 2019, I put together a very large installation that was inspired by my own and my family's immigration journey. And through doing that project and doing a lot of research into the family archives, and by family archives, I mean doing oral histories with my parents and looking at all of our immigration documents, I learned that my dad came to America as a graduate student in the early 90s at the exact right window of time that fit in with an executive order by President George H.W. Bush that basically made it easier for Chinese international students to get visas and stay in the United States. And the reason why he put out that executive order was because of the fallout of the Tiananmen Square massacre in China. It was partly due to wanting to do something about it and organizing by Chinese students in the US who were then afraid to engage with the Chinese state to get documents that they needed to stay in America. So political in that my dad at the time was really aware of this organizing both in China and subsequently in the US. I don't think he was an active participant. And part of my art show is about kind of processing how my ability to be in America is connected to all of this organizing that was happening all around me as I was just a little baby, and how amazing it is that movements can have such lasting consequences.
Did you have that immigrant push to get educated well and achieve in society that so many people have?
Intrinsically, yes, because I'm a nerd and I've always been a nerd. I've always loved to read and to learn. Outside, like from family influences, yes. I remember my grandfather, I was a little older at this point. I must have been in high school just asking my grandfather about his life growing up. And he told me an incredibly poignant story about, so my grandparents were for the most part illiterate. My grandfather had maybe elementary level schooling. And as part of the Great Leap Forward in China during that part of the communist era, he was set to work in some kind of metal refining factory. And even though he was very poorly educated, he had a good intuitive understanding about how to make processes in the factory much more efficient. And he was kind of celebrated as a model worker and asked to give a speech to the other workers. And he felt the weight of his lack of an education. And he told me that he just felt like a deep sense of shame that he was on this stage and didn't feel like he had anything to say, or he didn't know how to put into public speaking words what he wanted to express, and really carried that with him. He was a young man at that point, and that's the story that he told to his kids, like my dad, about the importance of being educated and being comfortable in those moments. So I would say yes, like education is very important. And I think about my grandfather's story a lot.
I've had a very good education, but I've had moments like that on stage anyway. So I think it's easy. There's a lot of ways in which one could have that feeling. I know that you did your undergraduate work at Stanford, and it seemed to me in a very interesting area and related to what you've done in your career. Tell me about that.
Yes, I entered Stanford as a 17-year-old thinking that what I was going to do with my life is that I would become a neurologist because I was really interested in human behavior, how the brain works, psychology. I wanted to have a career with some kind of social impact. Medicine seemed a really obvious route to go in. I really like biology and the sciences as well. And my first year at Stanford, I remember just feeling very bored in all of my pre-med classes. Like, they were interesting. I remember thinking, I have this wild opportunity to be here. I wish I were feeling more engaged in what I was learning. So I remember me and a very good friend of mine at the time, still extremely good friend, sitting down and like flipping through the entire course syllabus because we were having, you know, 17, 18-year-old existential crises about what are we going to major in? What should we learn that will shape the rest of our lives? Very dramatic. And through flipping through the course syllabus, I found Stanford's program in product design. And that was probably my first time realizing that design is a discipline that you could study. And it is a discipline that teaches you how to figure out what to make that can be manufactured at scale that other people can use. I always knew, of course, that objects in the world are created by other humans. I didn't know there was a formal discipline for figuring out how to make them. And I am glad that I took the time to read the 1,000-page course syllabus closely one night. And I remember reaching out to members of the Stanford Product Design Student Association and not being sure if I could switch my course from becoming a brain scientist to becoming a designer. They were extremely helpful, and I pivoted my journey after freshman year into studying design.
That strikes me as a really interesting and good choice, if you're happy with it, because I came into some understanding of that in a totally different way, which is I had built software, which requires a certain amount of design as both the programmer and the designer, because it was a one-person company at the time. And then years later, started a firm that did data visualization and started reading at that time about design from the standpoint of how do you make data exploring intuitive, useful, good-looking, things like that. And I've read a lot of that literature, which verges into product design and design thinking and things like that. And I have people working for me who have a lot more training than I do on that. And I just think also the position of product in a lot of companies is often really a leadership, creative, interesting place to be. And so I kind of envy you for having picked that and learning some of the theory about it as a young person. Did you feel like the course of study was a valuable one?
Oh, yes. Yes. I will tell you two anecdotes that come to mind. One is, so my sophomore year, I had decided I want to move in the direction of design, and I was deciding between a more sort of human-computer interaction focused study. At Stanford, the major is called Symbolic Systems. This spawned lots of Silicon Valley tech humans, and the product design course, which is within their School of Engineering, and a little more focused on visual design, industrial design, and manufacturing. And there were two introductory courses for each one. One was a CS course, and one was a course in the Studio Art program about design basics. And it was pretty clear which path I was going to go down, because there was one class that I was very happy to pull all-nighters for in my youthful energy, and that was the design course. So the computer science course, though, I still have a deep appreciation for computer science, and I do indeed work a lot with computers now. The second anecdote that I'll share is, taking a step back, it is very fascinating that when I entered college, it was still the era of flip phones, and product design at Stanford was not yet really focused on digital products. Human-computer interaction was really where thoughts around interaction design and digital interfaces were. Halfway through my undergraduate career was when the iPhone got announced. And then by the time that I was leaving, it still felt very new for design students to be interested in designing digital products over physical ones. I think that is entirely different now, many years later, that the focus of the program or the kinds of things that students want to work on. I think there are still like physical industrial designers there, of course, but there's a lot more emphasis on digital experiences.
I know that you went on to more study in a related area, but what did you do in between, and why did you choose to go get a master's?
Great question. I graduated. My very first job was to be the first designer at a small startup. I really don't feel this old, and in a way, I am not that old.
You don't look very old.
Reflecting on this, when I was working at the startup, I remember pivoting what we were working on because Microsoft just launched their first ever Windows Phone smartphone, and we could get some kind of support from Microsoft for building an app on their platform first. So I remember like reading the specs for the new Windows smartphone, which now feels so long ago. So that was my first job. We were working on a restaurant and nightlife recommendation app that was using cutting edge machine learning and artificial intelligence. So all of this new burgeoning AI conversation, it makes me feel old because it feels like, oh, this is like the third cycle of AI and products. Not to stray too far from your original question. So I was working in a Silicon Valley startup in most of the interim time between undergrad and grad school. And while working there, I really loved the agency with which to explore widely, move really quickly, ship things, see consumer feedback so fast after we very quickly were launching things, and also realized that I really needed to be working on social problems that I care deeply about. And while I learned a lot and really liked working with that team, I wanted to point my career in a direction where I could be applying my design and tech skills towards working on bigger social challenges than deciding where to eat at the end of the day.
So how did a MFA in interaction design fit into that?
I thought of grad school as a scaffolding, like a period of 1 to 2 years where I could really focus on the question of where can my design skills make the most impact and how do I find people that I want to work with or find organizations that I want to work with. I went into grad school with a very specific question on top of that, which is in undergrad, my senior thesis project was around design for disability, in that I prototyped a bowl for folks who have difficulty holding regular kitchenware. And this actually came out of experiences with my grandparents, where the way that many Asian American families, the kind of utensils that we use were not very well served by kitchenware for people with disabilities. So that really opened my eyes to how much room there was to improve experiences for folks who are aging or have health issues or other disabilities. And that's the question I went into grad school with. Like, how might I meet people or work on problems that affect the aging or folks with disabilities? In my interim time before moving to New York and going to grad school, I did spend some time freelancing in Pittsburgh. And it was there in Pittsburgh that I connected with some grassroots groups who were doing organizing around increasing access to public transit. And in that environment, I started thinking more about public services and public policy and the intersection between the kind of support at scale we can offer to folks with disabilities or those who are aging. A lot of that does come from government programs. And many of those programs might have the best intentions, or they might not actually have good intentions.
But they might not be well designed.
Yes, yes.
And they might not have a good citizen government interface.
Yes, yes. So in grad school is where I entered with all of these percolating among, you know, doing things that are better for those who are aging. Where do designers even fit when thinking about things like public policy or delivery of public services? And through being at SVA, I met folks who were very early at Code for America, folks who had worked on thinking through transit systems in New York City, Chelsea Malden from the Public Policy Lab. And all of those amazing humans really showed me that designers can and should exist in environments outside of Silicon Valley technology, and that our skills are very helpful in thinking about better, more dignified, more equitable delivery of public benefits. This like shift to focusing on public benefits and the social safety net more broadly defined the next phase of my career and also brought me into progressive politics and organizing.
Was Alloy the entry into progressive politics and organizing, or did it come before that?
Alloy was the first paid entry. I would say like way back when I was living in Pittsburgh, I was doing like guerrilla art installations with a public transit organizing group, but no one was giving money to that.
You seem like a fairly multi-talented person if you're ranging from potentially neurology to art to design and interest in policy. These are broad interests and requiring sometimes disparate skills.
That's a very nice way to put it, yes.
Tell me about how you landed with Alloy, because my perspective on Alloy, having been in the political technology world, and I was interviewing people like Dimitri Melhorn, who was working for Reid Hoffman, who was one of the funders there. And I also knew some of the firms and organizations that competed with Alloy. And that was kind of an entrant to the space that was intriguing, but I didn't really learn about it too much at the time. How did you land there and what did you see there?
Yeah. So prior to Alloy, I had spent a number of years deeply immersed in public interest design. So working within civic tech, Code for America, starting my own civic tech startup before that with Jimmy Chen at Propel, and had been at this organization called NAVA for many years. NAVA's start was part of the healthcare.gov rescue effort. This is now many years ago. The rollout of healthcare.gov did not go so well, and they pulled in a lot of tech folks to help with it.
Oh, including someone who ends up as part of Alloy, right?
Yes.
Like, yes.
Exactly.
Right. So, okay, I sort of see that connection.
Yes. So I'd been at NAVA for a while, really loved the work that I was doing on healthcare.gov, working at the VA on veterans benefits access, and then working with state governments on social safety net programs. And my time there certainly overlapped with the Trump administration. And increasingly, I felt like I was either doing firefighting or like architecture work, like rebuilding public benefit programs for the better with my teammates, while the people who were in charge of those programs were actively setting fire to what we were doing. And
yuck.
Yes, increasingly felt like it is important to have people inside of government still working on this through unfriendly administrations. It is important to have people outside of government, like NAVA, working closely with them. And it's important to have people working adjacent to all of those folks who are focused on bringing in non-arsonists into government. And I've been looking for an opportunity to get more involved in the upcoming 2020 cycle when I think through Mikey, I got tapped. I got a LinkedIn message from a recruiter at Alloy and kind of recruited in at a time when I was really, really looking for a way to move from in name, less partisan public interest tech into let's actually try to shake up who's in charge here.
Very fascinating. How was it when you landed there?
I joined in the fall of 2019, and I think there was a lot of curiosity, hope, and lots of product market fit figuring out.
Yeah. I had talked to Mikey back in September 2018 and later November. So I had some interaction pre-Alloy where he had these big ideas about tackling this and was a smart guy who was kind of an outsider. It was just interesting to see where he landed, finally raising a lot of money that he had wanted for previous projects. What did you think of the team?
I mean, overall, I feel appreciative of my experience. I learned a lot. Was it a roller coaster? Sure. Is working at a tech startup within the progressive politics ever not a roller coaster? Well,
probably almost any startup in any space tends to be a little roller coastery. One of the other people I've talked to is Jeremy Smith at Civitech, who picked up some of the pieces of Alloy at the end of things. Were you still there at all? Do you have any sense of that story and what caused the end of Alloy?
I left after the election in November 2020 for a number of reasons. I signed an NDA, so as much as you might want to hear some tea from me, I respectively cannot share it.
Does that NDA last forever?
That I don't know.
Yeah.
I can't recall.
Interesting. What did you do next?
Right afterwards, I started working with New America, and I was working on a project very timely at that time, and it's still something that I love talking about. We were working with the state of Colorado, trying to understand the best ways to effectively and thoughtfully talk about the COVID-19 vaccine with immigrant communities in the state of Colorado. So it was an interesting sort of content strategy, project, translation, and research to kind of understand how people were feeling about the vaccine at that time. And back in, you know, late 2020, this was before most people could have access to it. So they were doing pre-planning of how they might thoughtfully do communications. And I think it was great that they were trying to get ahead of reaching out to communities that otherwise the state has a hard time getting in front of and building trust with.
So, you know, what's the founding story for Trestle?
Yes, Trestle. I would say that it has roughly three parts. So part one happens in early 2020. Part one is one effort called Volunteer Experience 2020 that took place towards the end of 2019 and the first month or so of 2020 that was a program that was very focused on how do we improve the experience of volunteers who use tools for organizing? Since volunteers aren't the ones that are buying technology, they often don't really get a say in how the experiences work for them, but they're the people that are using it in very important ways. So my fellow partner, Molly Ruskin, was helping to run this program, and it was focused on pairing user experience experts with various tools in the progressive or larger movement ecosystem to kind of audit those tools and find places to improve the experience and then give out grants so that the organizations would have a carrot to want to and be able to make those changes. Around that time was also the Iowa caucus. What is the appropriate noun to use for what happened at the Iowa caucus?
Snafu.
Yes. Yes. As you may well know, right after that happened, the Nevada Dems were like, oh no, we're afraid this is going to happen to us next. How do we prevent this from happening?
They had hired the same team to build their caucus software, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there really wasn't a lot of time. So they pulled in a bunch of different tech people, sent them all to Nevada to all work together furiously to come up with an alternative thing that they could use.
It's a little bit like trying to revise the Obama healthcare website, but much smaller.
Yeah. It was like the healthcare.gov moment of our ecosystem.
You were doing these two things through an organization or on your own as just being pulled in on a kind of a tiger team or something? Or how did you find yourself in these positions?
Yeah. So during all of this part one activity, I was still at Alloy. And like, I knew that some Alloy folks had gotten pulled in to the Nevada rescue effort. But I personally wasn't very involved, just like understood that it was happening. My fellow partners, Molly and Sunil, were much more involved in this rescue effort, as were dozens of other great tech folks in the space. And coming out of it, there was a strong feeling that the space should have tech folks trained and at the ready for any other things that might just happen in 2020 that would affect the race. I think that this realization happened around the same time, maybe before COVID became everybody's problem, but that's just part one. I know that there were several different entities involved in the Volunteer Experience 2020 effort and the rescue effort, but it wasn't really, as far as I know, happening formally under any one org. I know Higher Ground Labs was involved. A couple donors were involved. Yes, to answer your question there.
So was that one of three or one and two of three?
That was one of three.
Okay, what was number two?
Part two is the practice of pulling in tech folks and recruiting them and vetting them and pairing them with ongoing technology needs throughout the 2020 cycle, that was generally within Higher Ground Labs, but, you know, a bunch of people who were pulled in as contractors, freelancers, and some donors in the mix too. And I think that worked out quite well for the movement overall during 2020. They worked on a bunch of different projects, shored up tech needs all over the place, did some crisis response. The ongoing motto there was no news is good news. And for the most part, we generated very little news about tech failures in the movement. Part three is where I come into the story. Part three is after the 2020 cycle, Molly and Sunil and a few other folks did a kind of reflective, how well did all that work? If we did it again, would we do it differently? Should we do it again? What should happen next for future cycles? And that's where the seed of what Trestle formerly became was planted. Like this idea that, yes, we should continue to bring in and retain great tech folks. We should have an ongoing entity that helps other orgs with their tech issues, however broad or diverse they might be. And it was around this time that I was wrapping up my work with New America and getting back in touch with Molly and Sunil about their journeys in 2020. And we were all kind of giving each other career advice and reflecting. And maybe it was a little bit of a right place, right time for everyone kind of a thing where they were like, hey, you know what, Zena, if you want to come back to political tech, we would love to start this thing formally with you.
And do I take it that the three of you are co-founders, or are there other people? What is the founding class of Trestle?
Yeah, the three of us are indeed. It really wouldn't be possible without other folks who are helping us think about it and support us. I don't think I can name the donors publicly, but they really helped us think about it and shape it and provided an important amount of seed funding.
Are you organized as a nonprofit or a for-profit? I mean, you're talking about donors, so I'm thinking nonprofit, but it can be in lots of different ways.
Yes. We are a C4. We have a fiscal sponsor for C3, and we also have a C-Corp. We just thought, why not all of the things?
Right. And where does most of your work take place?
The non-technical answer is across all three entities, and that, you know, this mix of different kinds of orgs allows us to work with a lot of different kinds of orgs more easily.
As a former founder in the space of a tech firm, it seems a little unusual to have another firm that you bring in for expertise. I mean, I guess we all use consultants in specific areas. I have heard from guests on my podcast, like Ari at Open Field, that it's the uptime part that she availed herself of and spoke really highly of your work as a team. If you are dealing with for-profit entities, are you charging for your services? Are you donating your services? How do you think about that relationship with different entities in different parts of the space that have different ways that they're formed?
Oh, yes. I think it's fun getting into the nitty-gritty of all of those nuances.
And well, I mean, you talked about being a nerd. This is my area of being curious and wondering, and also trying to share with this community what's going on and what they can avail themselves of if there are people like you out there.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Our goal is to make sure that great technology support, whether it's product management, design, qualitative research, security, reliability, scalability, all things engineering, can get to organizations that really need it as soon as possible and as accessibly as possible. And by accessible, I mean both the people that are working with them that we send there are not coming in with a savior mentality. They're coming in with a lot of respect for the wisdom and expertise of organizers or existing vendors in the space, and also that it meets them where they are budget-wise. And in order to make the budget part work, we do a lot of, we invest a lot of time and energy into raising grant funds that can help nonprofit entities receive in-kind or subsidized services. And in our for-profit org work, we want to add as much transparency as possible, but you know, some orgs can pay more than others. So through a for-profit work, it both helps sustain Trestle if we have clients who can pay our highest rate. And then that also helps subsidize work with other for-profit orgs.
Are the people who work through you for these groups, are they full-time employees, or is there a mix of different types of relationships that you have where you get a fractional person with a certain expertise, or how do you arrange that?
Yeah, there's a mix. For the most part, we have the Trestle Network, which is about 140 plus technologists who have been interviewed and screened and trained by us. And they span pretty evenly all of the disciplines that I named: design, product, engineering, and security. And those are folks who have varying availability. In the broad Trestle Network, there are folks who have full-time jobs, but are available for projects that maybe would benefit from more mentoring or advisory kind of guidance. There are folks who are happily full-time freelancers. So this is just one of other projects that they work on through Trestle. And there are folks who, for whatever reason, might be taking sabbatical or investigating their next move. Folks who've been in movement tech for a really long time and want to keep working in the space, but also don't want to burn out. So there's a big variety of folks in the network. We also, when grant funds enable us to do so, run a fellowship program. So we bring on people full time. The first cohort that we ran had a focus on senior technologists who were really interested in working in the movement, but had not been part of political tech or progressive tech previously. So this was a bringing new people in. As we're thinking about what our next fellowship program might look like, we are actively kind of thinking about, is that something that we should do again? Because that was really wonderful. And now we have some awesome new people that have now been in the space for, what, 2 years now through Trestle? Or do we open it up to be a little more around that retaining existing movement talent and creating a space for folks to continue working on projects a little flexibly and to share their experience back, or something else entirely? So the fellowship program is where we have more full-time folks that are part of the team. And then, of course, because everything has some nuance, two of our fellows from our first cohort have stayed on. It was kind of a journey, but they are now full-time employees of Trestle, and they're specifically working on a candidate recruitment tech tool that they helped incubate during their fellowship, and have, they've kind of turned into the founding team of this new product. And they're working with some clients and foundations on that piece.
Well, that gets spun out into its own org at some point, or would that be operated forever within Trestle, do you think?
That is part of that project's remit to figure out where that can sustainably live. It's something that we are open to a lot of different things, but that project is a good example of what we call Trestle Labs. Trestle Labs isn't a formal entity, but it's work that we do focused on like shared gaps across the progressive ecosystem, where we've kind of validated that there is this shared tech need. It's kind of an open question if it's a product or what kind of a thing is it? We have to figure it out. And the people that are working on it kind of live loosely at Trestle while we're figuring that out. So it's less of a consulting project and more of a we're figuring out some new tech responsibly here.
I once built a trestle table out of wood for my kitchen booth. And so my association with trestle is the underpinning of a piece of furniture. What's the source of the name for you guys? Why did you call it what you called it?
We wanted to think of a name that brought to mind the idea of infrastructure, like making these connections. And like, I guess a bridge is kind of an obvious one once you really think about it.
There's a lot of bridge in the world of progressive organizations. That word gets used. I've never seen trestle before. So maybe trestle is a better choice.
Yeah. I mean, I love physical infrastructure as well for my time in Pittsburgh, city of bridges.
Yeah.
And it's made for some fun team moments, you know, like happy hours, virtual happy hours, or trestle network gatherings where we all vote on our favorite bridge. It makes for a good icebreaker.
Could you give me a sense of the organizations that you end up working with? Are they predominantly higher ground labs, assisted companies? Do they go well outside of that? How do people find you? Where do you find your work?
Yes, I'll tell you about the kinds of orgs, and I'll tell you about how we have been finding people recently. So the kind of orgs, it is a real spread. And for that, we are very honored by all of the orgs that have decided to be open to meeting us and bringing us inside and working together on some thorny tech challenges together. They range from, I'll start with advocacy kind of organizations, from really big ones like the Sierra Club to a bunch of smaller in size but not in impact ones that are focused on issues like reproductive justice, like abortion funds, for example. Another category are technology providers, both for the movement and for sort of hard side specific.
What does a technology provider mean?
You could say vendor, but I think of it more as like organizations that are building and providing technology. And that ranges from higher ground labs affiliated newer teams to more infrastructure-y kind of orgs to everybody in between.
Can you give me a sense of the sort of the number of different entities at this point that you've engaged with? Is that in the tens, in the hundreds?
In terms of entities, it's over 50, 50.
Yeah. And what percentage of them would you say approximately are political software, data, true political tech firms in one form or fashion?
Like the orgs that are making or maintaining tech.
Yeah.
If I'm just guessing, I would say maybe between 30 to 40%.
If you were talking to the founder of such an organization, and there are so many more than 50, they're the third person on this call, let's say, or they're listening in later, which is more likely. What would you say to them if they have some reservations, right? Like reservations could be, I don't want to expose myself because my stuff is a mess and I don't want people to know. Or I have some secrets here and I'm not sure if they could be kept by an outside organization. Or I don't know if this is going to be too expensive. If you're talking to someone, what would you tell them about what working with you would be like?
Yeah. All right. Well, hello, future listeners who are doing the hard work of deciding to build or deciding to continue to build tech for the movement, which is famously not a lucrative endeavor or an endeavor that is good for your mental health.
There are some people who found ways to make it lucrative and good for their mental health. There are other people where it's been a big challenge. Of course, with any startup, most startups struggle more than succeed. That's just the nature of trying something new in the world.
Yeah. I would say, like, first of all, I have a lot of empathy for that and a lot of understanding. You know, Molly, Sunil, and I have all been through different kinds of roller coasters, all having to do with tech in this ecosystem. The first thing I would say is we would want to hear what those specific concerns are. I'd want to hear about what your org's goals are. What are you trying to accomplish with the tech that you are planning to build or the tech that you have built? And what are some roadblocks that you're perceiving, if you're comfortable sharing, to the concern of it's real messy in here, or like, there are some secrets in here. I would say, well, one, Team Trestle is both a transparent org in that we want to tell you like how we do things and why we do things, but we're not a leaky org. We are not documenting things to tell other people about them.
Do you sign like an NDA? Like you just earlier in this conversation honored one that you had signed. Do you do that with these organizations that you work with?
Yes, yes. Yeah. And I would also say legally, we are happy to sign an NDA earlier in the process. And when we actually enter into some kind of contractual relationship, there is certainly an NDA.
So sometimes people ask me for advice along the way in some of these types of organizations. One of the things that often comes to me is the question, should I rebuild this thing from scratch? Because a lot of times when you're building a minimum viable product or whatever we want to call it, the first iteration, you make mistakes, or the first technologists that you hire aren't as good as you thought, or you learn something about how it doesn't scale well, or how would you field that kind of question generally? Obviously, the specifics matter a lot to the answer.
Yeah, I think a lot of it depends on, one, what are you trying to do with the newer version? Two, what does your org's capacity look like for maintaining whatever version of the technology is for however long it needs to exist in the world? It's like the answer to two will probably be fairly revealing. And then in general, if we can find an existing off-the-shelf thing that could be modified in a non-thorny way that is generally more sustainable than investing a lot of time and money into building something from scratch that you then have to maintain.
Well, a lot of times people who are building something or rebuilding something, it's their intellectual property that they're working on. They don't want to necessarily employ something else. And hopefully these are innovative people doing something new, but you're right. There are certainly plenty of cases where it makes no sense to reinvent the wheel. And when something that's had a lot of resources into it over a long period of time and is successful, it's harder than you think probably to duplicate it or to compete with it or whatever. It may not make sense. From this vantage point, which you've had at Alloy and now currently at Trestle, what's your perspective on the progressive political technology space generally? Is it low functioning, functioning, or high functioning from your viewpoint?
I think that we are collectively doing a lot with what we have. What we have is like a pool of resources that is pretty small compared to other fields of consumer technology.
Are you talking about capital?
Yeah. 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 And what we have are really smart, really involved, and really scrappy people that, sure, we get into arguments. We're kind of pokey, testy sometimes, but
competitive.
Yeah. But
opinionated.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's
the nature of humans, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And that is, I think, the most rewarding part of working in this space is working with people who are so aligned in values, in commitment to building power. And the more we can do to help one another be in this space with care and sustainability, the better overall we are.
When people talk about capital, I mean, that's one way to build an enterprise. Another way to build an enterprise is to be funded by your customers or even to bootstrap it so that you only are reliant on money coming from customers. Sometimes you have an idea that's good enough, you can sell it in advance to key organizations and they can help you build it. What do you think of that balance based on what you've seen around? If you're advising someone contemplating a startup in political tech, how would you think they should balance the idea of seeking capital versus the idea of seeking customers?
As someone with a design and product background, I would say it'd be hard to build a constructive business if you're making something that people don't want, or you're making something that people don't find useful, or people feel forced to use because there's no alternative. So,
and in fact, it's a very bad business idea, even if you could raise money and sort of use it up to your own benefit. I guess probably why I asked the question is it feels to me like the closer you can get the sooner to the people who are going to want or not want what you got, the better off you are and the more likely you are to be successful or find out that you can't be.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Does this make you want to, so you've done, gone and started Trestle and it's, I'm assuming it's a good place for you. It seems like you're enthusiastic about it. Does it make you want to start a product enterprise perhaps on your own someday where you could directly design your own product and get it out there if you see a gap or a need?
I was going to say, I'm not going to rule it out. And then I had a meta thought like, wow, that's a really politician phrase to use. I will say that I don't currently feel a sense of unfulfillment because I'm not working on a sort of product.
Well, you might be working on other people's product companies, yeah, for one thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I think there are some designers out there, and like, I think both viewpoints are valid, that like really want to make things, and then other designers who are interested in shaping organizations or creating spaces for other people to make things. I think at the moment I'm more in the latter bucket. I don't feel a pull towards, I would like to work on a product at the moment. I really like the variety of working with a bunch of different orgs and working with a bunch of different folks in the Trestle Network and our fellows and thinking about their career trajectories. I also feel like I kind of scratched the, I need to make something itch with my life as an artist outside of political tech. However, I'm very like problem driven. So if we stumble upon a real problem that no one else is solving and the humans and business entities of Trestle are well positioned to dig in, I wouldn't say no.
Tell me about your co-founders in a little more detail. What do they bring? How do they complement you?
I could talk about them at length. They're so great. I also just realized we're a little bit over time, so I will have to keep this succinct just for time. I love them dearly.
Okay.
I'll start with Sunil. Sunil runs all things engineering, amongst many other, because everyone wears lots of different hats. Like myself and Molly, Sunil and I met in civic tech. So we worked at the VA together at the same time on some big systemic problems. He left to enter political space earlier than I did. He was recruited to join Cory Booker's campaign as deputy CTO, I believe, back in the primaries.
That was the presidential?
Yes, yes. And Molly and I also go way back to civic tech days. She coincidentally also spent a lot of time at the VA, though slightly not overlapping with Sunil and I. We kind of joke about how we, like, the VA strangely is this entity that we share this overlap with. Molly's specialties are many. She's also a designer and researcher like me. She leans a little more into product these days. And out of all of us, she spent the most time before her tech career in grassroots organizing. And coming out of her government days, she also spent some time doing strategy consulting and overlapped with folks in philanthropy.
So, you know, what should I have asked you in this interview that I failed to?
I could talk to you more about Uptime and our other programs that are coming up this year.
Tell me more about Uptime and the other programs that you have coming up this year.
Happy to. So, Uptime 2024 is our evolution of the program that came before Trestle existed formally. That program was called Uptime 2020. Uptime 2024 is very similar, where it is our effort to proactively shore up the most important technology tools for election-related organizing or election outcomes. So through Uptime, we are identifying a lot of tech needs across the space and pairing excellent humans from the Trestle Network to work on those problems. We're also reserving some funds for any rapid response that might occur later in the cycle, because at this point in 2020, we didn't really know what the biggest problems were coming down the pipe later on in the cycle.
One could even imagine that there would be outsider efforts to disrupt our technology.
One could imagine that.
Hopefully not, or hopefully not successfully.
One other program I want to tell you about that is coming down the pipe, and we'll have some more public announcement about it soon, is our new pilot tech mentorship program. And this is our effort to, in a more structured way, pair folks in the movement who want to level up their technology decision-making fluidity and capacity with senior tech leaders who are movement friendly, and kind of make these mentor-mentee pairs that will work together throughout the year in a more advising capacity.
That sounds pretty cool. I could imagine a lot of people who would love to have that kind of relationship out there.
Yes. And due to some funding that we're very thankful to have, the mentees will be able to receive their mentoring help for free.
Awesome. Any other programs that you guys are operating or launching?
Like I mentioned before, we're still thinking about the right way to approach the fellowship program this year during like kind of a time-sensitive election year. So stay tuned for that. We haven't landed on how we want to approach that yet.
Well, Zina, I've really enjoyed getting to know you a little bit and understand what Trestle's up to. Sounds like a really good resource for the space, and I'm glad it's out there. Anything else you want to say?
Just a lot of appreciation for you hosting me on the show.
Thank you. That was Zina. She is at trestle.us. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found. The Great Battlefield is now part of the Democracy Group Podcast Network. Visit democracygroup.org to learn more about other podcasts that cover democracy and civic engagement. You can also help me by leaving comments and good ratings on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere, and by sending me suggestions for great guests to nperlman@gmail.com.